Welcome to the Bob Siegel Show. It's good to be with you. I hope you're having a great Thanksgiving weekend and that you already had a great Thanksgiving celebration. We are going to continue with a series today. We've been talking about hope and the promises of God, and I mentioned that there are promises related to suffering and trials and that we were going to take an especially detailed look at that. We will continue with that series today. We'll begin talking about the subject of suffering and trials. First, another thing this program does is comment on pop culture, sometimes in a lighthearted way. A few years ago, my beautiful wife Dana came on the air with me, and we had a fun, spirited debate about Hallmark movies. She loves them. I felt a little bit differently about them. I'm going to replay that for you first, then we'll get back to our discussion from the Bible. But the reason I'm giving you this explanation in present-day time instead of just replaying the conversation is that a lot has happened since then. It's become a little bit dated. Hallmark, since then, has capitulated and caved into the LGBTQ community, putting pressure on them to make movies about gay couples. And yet Hallmark, for all these years, has touted itself as being about family. And of course, the LGBTQ community would claim this is about new family values. All to say that Dana and I do not watch Hallmark movies anymore. There's a new network. It's called American Classics or something like that. I don't think I'm saying it quite right, but a lot of the people who wrote for Hallmark and acted for Hallmark are doing that. So in a sense, Dana still watches these same kinds of movies, which means the conversation in that regard is still relevant. But you will hear us refer to the word Hallmark in this conversation, this lighthearted conversation, before we had the concern about them caving in. And I wanted you to understand that. I'm replaying it because in spirit, we're still debating these kinds of movies, even though the phrase Hallmark is now, as far as we are concerned, dated. Here's our conversation from Christmas time a few years ago. Dana and I want to talk about other holiday movies besides the classics such as It's a Wonderful Life and Miracle on 34th Street. Yes, I'm talking about Hallmark Christmas movies. Dana loves them. She watches tons of them. From time to time, we watch one together. Now, we do have different reactions, hers being just a tad bit more on the positive side. I will concede, I'm conceding, honey, I will concede that they are beautifully filmed with breathtaking scenery. They are also heartwarming, something we want during the Christmas season. And of course, we already know the ending to Home Alone, Charlie Brown, and the others. So it's nice to have original, unpredictable stories. Just one problem. Hallmark movies are neither original nor unpredictable. The characters change, the actors change, but the story is always the same. I would like to present to you a Bob Siegel Show debut, my own outline for a Hallmark Christmas movie. Usually they have the word Christmas somewhere in the title. I'll put it in my title too. I call this a generic Hallmark Christmas. Here's the plot. Follow carefully. A big business tycoon, already engaged to a woman who also loves both business and the big city, is sent to a small town to help his company buy up the land and put in a new mega shopping center. This will involve many owners of charming stores and charming homes needing to sell, and it already looks like the town needs to sell to someone because the wood mill that kept their economy going for so many years has long since closed down. But should they sell this charming little town, along with its special Christmas celebration every year, will never be the same again. They will, for all intents and purposes, cease to exist. The businessman does not mind spending his Christmas working on a traveling project because he hates Christmas. At the beginning of the movie, somebody always hates Christmas. He poses as a reporter coming through town to write about their famous annual Christmas scavenger hunt. While here, the businessman meets a hometown girl in her 20s who helps her dad with the family bookstore. At first, she and the businessman do not get along. This is very important. At first, they do not get along. Why? Because later in the movie, they will get along. Not only will they get along, they will fall in love. Now, it won't happen quickly, mind you. After all, there's a two-hour movie to fill. Well, more like 90 minutes with commercials. But slowly, the businessman will become enamored with both the town and the girl. They will be teamed together on the scavenger hunt. He will not be revealing during this time that he's checking out the town for purposes of buying and rebuilding. That will happen later. But on the scavenger hunt, he will at least have a candid moment where he confesses that he grew up hating Christmas because Dad and Mom never got along during Christmas time. And there will be an awkward moment somewhere in the film where City Boy and Hometown Girl start to get feelings for each other and quickly cover it up. There will also be a moment where somebody in town mistakes them for a couple and tells them what a nice couple they make, making them feel even more awkward. Late in the movie, their Christmas traditions will start to grow on him. Also late in the movie, they will almost kiss, but somebody will walk into the room and interrupt them before they get a chance, jumping jiminy. At some time in the film, some senior citizen, probably the girl's widowed father, will have a profound heart-to-heart talk with the lad about things really important in life. You see, earlier he had concluded that this dude would be perfect for his daughter. Also late in the movie, we have an ingredient mandatory to every Hallmark film, the big misunderstanding. In this case, it will be his old girlfriend who surprises him by popping in at an inopportune moment to tell him she decided to join him in this little town for Christmas. This big city girlfriend will also inform Hometown Girl that her newfound friend was only scoping the town to do major redevelopment. She'll be devastated. Here's a sample of the snappy dialogue. You were just using me. At first, maybe, but in time, I came to really care for you. In fact, I already called my boss and told him the deal is off. Honest, I meant to tell you. See, it's only the timing that's off. The big misunderstanding. Naturally, everything gets worked out. Not only does the guy stay, he uses his creative business sense to develop the town into a tourist attraction. He saves the town. He saves Christmas to boot. Of course, he marries Hometown Girl and sends City Girl packing. Well, there you have it. You heard it here first. A generic Hallmark Christmas. Now, to be fair, there are some variations to these stories. It could be a big city woman who meets a hometown man, and the man could be helping with his mom's farm instead of his dad's bookstore. Okay, now I'll let Dana go ahead and give you her view of Hallmark movies. They're a little different than mine. So if you like Hallmark movies, don't turn the radio off. I think you'll feel better after you listen to Dana.
Wow, that was everything
everything you've ever seen in a Hallmark movie, more or less.
Well, so in our house, imagine all of that Bob just said. When we'd be watching a Hallmark, he'd be expressing these things along the way and making predictions, and that was fun. But then It got to be out of control.
Which I did. I was spoiling the movie.
Yes. And as a writer, I get it. He's a story writer. He's a creative story writer.
Well, I wasn't spoiling the plot.
Nobody can spoil
that plot.
He's very creative. But I watch Hallmarks to escape, to have a lovely break from reality, to know that it's always going to turn out okay in the end.
And I get
which
that.
Is why I watch them.
Life can be intense. In fact, even on this show, we do the news a lot. We're taking a break from the intensity even this week. So yes. I get that. We need a break.
I watch Hallmarks for a different purpose than Bob does.
Bob's tell them about watching the new way I make predictions.
Okay, I'm getting there. Okay. See, this is how intense he is at home too.
Tell him, honey.
So Bob would be expressing his thoughts all through the movie, which you can ignore to a point. But then after a while, he just got to be quite exuberant. So we made this deal a couple of weeks ago that now when we watch Hallmarks, he has to text me his predictions and thoughts and whatever. And then it doesn't ruin the movie.
And then when the movie's
me.
Over, she reads them all. get the majority.
And then
of them.
We count how many he got right and how
However,
many.
However,
like,
the movie, her phone's ding, ding.
Yes.
She's going, the movie just started. You're predicting the ending already?
Within 5 minutes, he's already speed typing.
And I'm going, what ending?
Yes, I know. So I do. I know Hallmarks are redundant. I know they're similar, but that's a part of what I like is that I can count on them to not throw me a curveball when I'm just trying to relax.
I have a question for you. And I do get, again, wanting something with a happy ending. But my stories, which you're always saying you like, do not have happy endings. They're not unhappy either. They're what I'd call bittersweet. But they certainly don't wrap everything up with tidy endings. I write them that way deliberately. So how do you reconcile that with saying you'd prefer something with a happy ending?
Because I'm reading your books with a different purpose. I'm watching Hallmarks to escape and get away. And to relax, I read your books for the story and the intrigue and the creativity. And I'm always amazed at the creativity. I keep thinking nobody can think of a newer thing to write in a book after all these years of writing. And yet you do it over and over and over. So I love your books because of the adventure and the unpredictability of it. It's
so
completely
that means
opposite.
Else, something written by someone else that was unpredictable, you would like that too.
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Yeah. Okay. But I do like Hallmark for a different reason. And one of my goals when I'm watching Hallmark is to look for ones that Bob will be a little tripped up on because they aren't predictable or they have different. And we just found one this last week, A Shoe Addict's Christmas. We would recommend that.
Still predicted about 8 things that I texted
but
you on your phone.
It's a modern day
version. The ones that
version.
Are magical and have Santa, there's... Then they can work in some kind of twist.
It's a modern day version of the Christmas Carol. And it is as clever as Hallmark gets. This is a really clever one. And it is cheesy, but it also is pretty creative compared to most of them.
I should say they made a very unpredictable one years ago, and it's in the Smithsonian Institute. So you can see it there.
Okay, whatever. I hope Hallmark's not listening right now. But anyway, I love Hallmark, just in case they are. You only need to listen to this radio program once to figure out that Bob has very strong opinions on a wide variety of issues. But one of Bob's strongest passions is freedom of speech itself, even when such speech challenges his own convictions. So feel free to send Bob a comment or a thought-provoking question. You can reach Bob on Facebook or questions@bobsiegel.net.
This is Bob Siegel. As a Christian apologist, I hear scorning and ridicule all the time from Bible skeptics and unbelievers. Some churches will still respond to such people with love and understanding. Others do not.
You Christians are such morons. There's no proof that God exists, and only a pea brain would believe in miracles. Wake up! Step into the 21st century. Besides, Christianity is responsible for most of the world's problems.
I find your lack of faith disturbing.
Relax, my friends. That's not the kind of response you'll get from Skyline Church. We welcome you just as you are, with all your doubts, all your questions, and all your concerns. Your problems with religion are understandable, and I promise at Skyline you'll experience the love of Jesus Christ, not the revenge of a Sith Lord.
Skyline Church.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Thank you. We've been doing a series on the promises of God, and most of the promises are things we love getting promised. On the other hand, occasionally God promises some things that we just assume he not offer, and one of them is we are told that even as Christians, even after we give our lives to him, we are going to have trials. Trials were par for the course. 1 Peter 4, 12 and 13. Dear friends, do not be surprised at the painful trial you are suffering as though something strange were happening to you. But rejoice that you participate in the sufferings of Christ so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed. I'll never forget the day my dad found out that I was a Christian. I was in my second year of junior college, still living at home, going to school as a commuter student. My dad discovered that I was a Christian and immediately pronounced me dead, disowned me, and said I had to leave home. Had I been aware of this verse in Peter, I would have been a little more comforted because at that time, I did think that something unique to me and something strange and surprising was happening to me. But as I just pointed out, we all go through trials. Maybe not like that. Maybe your parents never disowned you. I hope they never do, but we all go through something. And there are parts of the world and times of history where Christians go through major persecution. This is what was going on in Peter's day. This is the kind of trial that he was talking about. What I was experiencing with my dad was nothing compared to this. However, I don't mean to minimize what you are going through. Your life is the only life you will ever live. Your life is the only life you have lived so far. And if you're going through some kind of suffering or trial, it's not really that comforting to say, well, there's other people in the world that have it worse than me. So how do we unpack all of this? Well, the Bible does tell us why suffering exists in the world in general. The Bible does tell us why evil is in the world in general. A lot of suffering, not all of it, but a good deal of suffering is a result of evil. So a large, large chunk of this question is very well, very specifically answered in the Bible with detail. The Bible does tell us in general why suffering is in the world and why God allows suffering in the world. However, the Bible does not tell us why evil and suffering is proportioned the way it is. The Bible will not tell you why a little six-year-old girl dies of leukemia, but some mobster lives to be 80, 90 years old. Well, first, we'll start with suffering in general, and then we'll get into the specific kinds of trials we have and how to deal with those. First of all, I want to begin with empathy. This is a very understandable question. One thing all of us have in common as human beings, regardless of our different beliefs, regardless of whether we believe in a God, don't believe in a God, believe in a heaven, don't believe in a heaven, we have all, at times in our lives, experienced suffering. We have all watched the news and know that other people are suffering. So we can begin with empathy. This is something we have in common. This is a question we have in common. This is a confusion that we have in common. However, as far as this being a specific challenge to the Bible, as far as suffering in the world somehow suggests that maybe Jesus Christ isn't who he claimed to be, I want to tell you something. This is not a unique problem to Christianity. It's a problem for any religion or any philosophical view of God or any view of any kind of deity in this universe. If any God exists, if any kind of God exists, whoever he is, he allows suffering, right? Now, how do I know that? Because suffering exists. Suffering is here. Suffering is a reality. So if God exists, he has some kind of reason for allowing suffering. And this is not a unique problem with the Bible. It would challenge every single religion. If you're a Hindu, if you're a Buddhist, if you're Jewish, it challenges you. So that's the first thing we need to point out. This is not a unique problem to the New Testament. This is not a unique problem to Jesus Christ. However, if we're going to accept Jesus Christ, if we're going to accept that the Bible, Old and New Testaments, are the Word of God, we would expect some kind of explanation about why a loving God allows suffering and evil in the world. Why doesn't God do something about the evil in the world? My friends, he did do something about it. Early in the first century, he became a man, and in 33 AD, he died on the cross and paid the penalty for our selfishness, our sin, which is the cause of evil, which is the germ of suffering in this world. He did do something about it. And anybody that gives their life to Jesus Christ has the promise that they will someday live forever in heaven. That may sound too good to be true, but there will be a time and there will be a place when never again will evil or suffering exist. No more sickness, no more death, no more sadness, no more crying. We're even told that Jesus personally will wipe away every tear. Okay, so I'm talking to a skeptical friend, and you know what he's going to say. That's a cop-out. Okay, Jesus did something about the suffering 2,000 years ago. Why doesn't he do something about it right now? I see a lot of evil in the world right now. Why can't God just come along and wipe out all evil? Well, my friend, according to the Bible, you have an evil side too. I'm not saying that you're 100% evil. I am saying that we're all composites of good and evil. If a loving, holy God cannot allow any evil into his kingdom, and you want him to destroy all evil, fine. You want God to wipe out all evil? Do you want him to start with you? I don't want him to start with me. Very related to this question is the question of why would a loving God send people to hell? Now, a lot of times people don't immediately see the connection, but let me show the connection. You're bothered by a God who would sit back and allow suffering and evil in the world and not do anything about it. On the other hand, there's a very major, clear doctrine in the Bible which says God will do something about it. God will hold all evil people accountable, and there will be a place called hell. Those concerns are contradictory. You're bothered that God would sit back and not do anything. You're bothered that God says that actually he's going to do quite a bit about suffering and evil. You see, we're made in the image of God, and we can see in our own image the reason God has his standards. If a judge in a courtroom let a murderer run free, we would consider him not a loving judge, but an irresponsible judge. And so we do need to believe that a loving God would send people to hell. On the other hand, a compassionate, merciful God who knows that all of us have an evil as part of our nature, that we can change our actions, but we can't change our thoughts, we can't change our feelings, we can't help the way we were born, this God would also be merciful. And there, again, we can get back to the courtroom analogy. If there were some criminal who really regretted what he did, and the judge could really see this, and he really repented, and he was really sorry, the judge might say, okay, I'm going to give you another chance. God has given us another chance. So he did something about our evil on the cross. He gives us our entire life to decide whether we're going to accept Jesus or not. In the meantime, we're making choices. And the ability to do right includes the ability to do wrong, because otherwise it's not a real ability. So in the meantime, while we're spending our whole lives and God is giving us our entire life to decide whether we're going to accept the mercy of Jesus or whether we're going to take the ultimate punishment and go to hell for all of eternity, one way or the other, our sin, our evil will be dealt with, but we're given our entire lives to decide. And in the meantime, we are making choices. And yes, they're bad choices because we have free will. Now, at this point, some people like to tell me, well, then I wish God hadn't given us free will. No, you don't. You can say that, but you don't. You don't. I can prove it to you. When you were in high school, you were counting the days when you could finally get out of the house and be away from your parents' authority. No more rules. No more curfews. You wanted freedom. What are most wars fought about? Freedom. What are most revolutions fought about? Freedom. You can ask why God created you with a free will. God didn't want a puppet on a string. God didn't want to program a robot. God didn't want to give you a love potion and make you love him against your will. God wanted people in his image, not that we look like God, but in his image, meaning we make choices, we create, we're sentient beings, we have freedom of will. You see, good and evil are not things. Good and evil are not substances which you can look at in a test tube. God did not create good or evil. God created human beings, and human beings make choices. And when we make these choices, we choose good or choose evil. It's the result of something we choose. What God created was human personality. Okay, well, that's a little bit about why we have good and evil in the world in general. What about the specific trials we go through? What about when one person goes through something and somebody else doesn't? There's a lot of mystery involved here, but there's a lot of guidance in the scripture of how to make our way through, and we will talk about that. In the meantime, this is Bob Siegel making the obvious obvious.
The Bob Siegel Show is sponsored in part by the law offices of Matthew Simone.